and welcome to Ed Talks, the podcast from King Edward School Birmingham and King Edward's High School for Girls, where I interview old Eds who've gone into many different fields, but they all have one thing in common, because they've absolutely risen to the top of them. My name is Ben Anderson. I left school in 2006, and I run a podcast production company called Sound Rebel. Today, I am joined by a former BBC News presenter with over 20 years' experience, including being a rolling news anchor for BBC World News, as well as an investigative journalist for Panorama and The Money Programme. She's now a conference host, a motivational speaker, and a coach. I'm delighted to be joined by Neisha Pillay. Neisha, thank you ever so much for your time today. How are you?
I'm very well. Great to be with you, Ben.
Neisha, you've had an extraordinary career, and I'd love to talk to you more about it. You've been on air for some of the world's biggest moments, and I'd love to talk about those later on. But first of all, let's go back to Birmingham, to King Edward School. You left school at the end of the 70s, and you were at KHS for 4 years, is that right?
Yes, just a scant 4 years, yeah. I arrived at KHS at the age of about 14, 15. We'd just moved from India to Birmingham. It's the first time outside India. There was no internet, remember. I had no clue what Birmingham, what Britain was going to be like. And in the middle of the 70s, it was a pretty grim place, I can tell you. But KHS was like a beacon.
And why did your family move to the UK?
It was quite a difficult time politically in India at the time. And my father had a job offer from the UK, and I don't think he put a lot of thinking into it, to tell you the truth. He just thought, okay, I'm out of here. And there we were. We landed up in Birmingham with very little to our name. It was quite a shock, I can tell you.
And were you consulted as a child? Was it talked about? No?
Absolutely not. It came as a complete surprise. In fact, I only discovered a few months after my father had decided to move us to, look at the language I'm using, to move us. But there were very different times. And of course, an Indian male, you know, very much a paterfamilias and all that. It just happened. And we went along with the flow.
And how did you feel at the time moving to not just schools, but countries at the age of 14?
Oh, I felt really angry. I was very connected with the world. I read Time magazine in India. It was a very politically active time. You may or may not, you won't recall, of course, Ben. And Watergate, and I knew that Maggie Thatcher had just been appointed the first female leader of the Conservative Party. She was an opposition leader at the time. And I knew that Britain was going to the dogs. I knew that there'd been a terror attack in Birmingham. And I was shocked we were going to this place, you know, armpit of the universe, I said to my father. What on earth are we doing going to Birmingham? But hey, Birmingham made me.
And you said that it was a bit of a grim place at the time in the 70s. Can you tell me about that? What was Birmingham like? Because I remember my mum and dad, who are of a similar generation to you, talking about how they'd never go into town when they were younger. And cause you know, for us and my generation, every Friday we'd be in the city centre. But what was it like in the 70s?
Yeah, so you must remember, Ben, Britain in the 70s was a kind of black and white sort of place, a grim place. There was a lot of industrial strife. I went to London University later, and London then was not the city it is now. So it wasn't just Birmingham, just to be fair to Birmingham. But in terms of Birmingham itself, well, I also came from Bombay, which is a very, very hip and vibrant and beautiful city. So you know, it was hard to make the comparisons and get them to stack up in Birmingham's favour. The heart had been taken out of the city by city planners post-war. Remember, the city was very badly bombed because it was the industrial heartland of Britain. And so they didn't really have an attractive city centre with all those underpasses. And it was very hard to navigate your way as a pedestrian. And I think the city fathers from the 90s onwards have spent a lot of money reinventing the city and putting the heart and the soul back into the city. But in a post-war, when the economy was difficult, that was not a priority. And so this, I think the city lost a lot of what it must have once been.
So KHS you described as a shining beacon in and amongst this doom and gloom that was the city of Birmingham in the mid-70s. What was it like going, you know, stepping into the school for the very first time?
It was really strange. All those wood-panelled corridors, and I must have been the only person in the school, maybe in the whole history of the school, ever to join without an exam, a written exam, to have to sit and pass. I just did an interview, and I was interviewed by the then head, who was a truly awesome, iconic woman called Jean Wilkes. And I remember sitting in her wood-paneled study thinking, what is this? Where am I? Now, these days, kids would, I guess, have a reference to Harry Potter or something like that. So I was just mesmerized. She had a thistle brooch on her left shoulder. I'd never seen anyone wear a brooch before. And somehow I must have got through the interview because I had a place. And I had no idea what a privilege it was to get into the school. I don't think my parents had. I had no idea it was such a great school. And it gradually dawned on me over the years that, you know, I'd really lucked out in the lottery of life.
I mean, it's an incredibly formative time, isn't it? That kind of those teenage years, especially 14-year-old girl, moving country, moving schools. What kind of cultural differences were immediately apparent to you between your school in India and KEHS?
The cultural differences were screaming out really to me on every level. So if we just look at the schools, they were very different. I went to a very cool school in India. It was co-educational and had very, very rich extracurricular life. Now, KEHS at the time didn't. Firstly, it was a girls' school and all the girls were obsessed with the boys next door, which I simply couldn't understand. And the extracurricular activities provided by the school were really quite meager in those days. That's really not the case anymore. But in those days, it was just academically focused. And girls were sort of bussed in from such a large hinterland that they then wanted to just get on their buses and go home, couldn't wait to get home. And so people didn't really, I don't know, the school didn't focus on providing great sport and great art and music and theatre, which is what I was particularly into. Oh my gosh, the theatre was really dire when I was there, compared to the school I went to in Bombay. However, the culture shock went way beyond school. It's about the music. I mean, I'd never watched television before. We didn't have a television in India. And then I end up as a career working for the BBC. Yeah, kind of ironic. Music, clothes. I went to a jeans shop for the first time on whatever it was called, New Street. And I had no clue what to do. I'm just standing there looking around thinking, oh my word, what do I do now? Going into a pub for the first time, it was truly a horrifying experience. I just stood there paralyzed. I just copied everyone around me. So, you know, those are the things that are more memorable, actually, more than school even. It's the music and the pubs and the jeans shops. And how does one look cool when you don't understand any of the cultural references?
And how long did it take you, would you say, to settle?
Oh, who knows? In some ways, no time at all. In other ways, it took quite a long time. But the school was very welcoming. I think the girls' school was really quite unique because the leadership, the whole culture of a school is set by the head. And we had this remarkable head, Miss Jean Wilkes, and she was the head for 2 years. And then we had another one for my second 2 years, Miss Evans, who was also a very interesting woman right at the beginning of her career, her first headship. Miss Wilkes had her last headship with us. She then went on to become Vice Chancellor of Birmingham University, which is a remarkable step in itself to make, from a secondary school to the tertiary sector. And she was so tremendously, I don't know how to describe her really. She was truly a Mensch, if you know the German word. She had a kind of humanity about her, a deep humanity and a deep sense of service to the community, which I think infected all of us. I was really profoundly inspired by her.
Nisha, you said that you're the only person that you know that didn't pass an exam to get into the school. I think you're the first person we've had on this podcast who joined at 14 and spent kind of half the school career there. Obviously, you did your O-levels and your A-levels. I'd like, if you wouldn't mind, to briefly talk about identity. And how much of your Indian identity did you bring to the school? Did you have to adapt to the people around you completely? Could you bring your heritage into that environment?
Yeah, I brought a lot, actually. The school was so different from how it is now. I was the only non-white girl in the year of 90 plus pupils. Can you believe that, Ben?
No, not looking at the school now. No, and it's one of the things I love about the school is how multicultural it is.
It's not the way it is, yeah. And I was shocked. I thought these girls were so ignorant because I spent my time reading Time magazine and trying to find out what was going on in the world beyond India. Whereas girls KHS were nowhere near as political as I was. And I was also just bulgy and angry for having been moved from Bombay to Birmingham. So and because Miss Wilkes was so accepting, she allowed me to be this rather bulgy, Indian, arrogant little girl. I must have been very offensive, I think. And so, yeah, I really had a platform to be myself, to talk about India, to talk about Hinduism, to talk about cooperatives and socialism. And the school was very tolerant.
So you were, to use your words, Nisha, a bulshy teenager, reading Time magazine, very aware of the world around you. We know that you're a former BBC News presenter. You'd think that you went straight from King Edwards to study journalism, but you didn't. You studied economics at LSE. What was the decision? What was the process behind that decision?
Oh, it was completely nutty. There was no internet, remember? I think I was sweet on a lad who studied economics or something. It was as random as that. I knew nothing about economics, and it was in some ways a mistake to choose to study it at university because it wasn't offered by the school at A level. I think they somewhat despised economics as an A level, as not being sufficiently rigorous. You know, it was quite academically elitist. Well, you know that. And so I did physics, chemistry, maths, A level. And probably should have gone down a scientific route. But hey, I was determined I was going to do economics. And at the time, and I think even now, you don't have to do economics A-level to get into some of the best economics degree courses. So I sailed into LSE with no clue about what economics really was. I thought it was a tool to understand the world, you know, to put right all the ills of the world. But it so isn't like that.
Did you enjoy it? Or was it kind of immediately when you got there, you realised that this isn't for me?
I'm not sure one would say enjoy it. My son is at LSE right now, and I know a lot of his friends are economists. I don't think any of them enjoy it, to tell you the truth. I didn't dislike it, I have to say. I enjoyed the maths. I quite like the logic of it, the building of the models, the inherent beauty of building a model. But it wasn't what I thought it would be. So that was disappointing. It's not actually a very practical tool, economics. So in that sense, I was disappointed. And it's very demanding mathematically. And you have to be prepared for that. I'm not sure that everyone around me was necessarily. I don't think it's necessarily advertised well enough to students that the actual sort of soul of the subject is very well wrapped, and it should be more obvious to students what it is economics is about. And what is it about? In my opinion, it's an exercise in logic. And if you're not interested in logic, you shouldn't study economics.
I completely relate to that. I did an economics A-level, and I think I almost thought it would be more... we had Anya Duxbury on the podcast last week. She's a recent KHS leaver. She studies anthropology over at Queen's Belfast. And I, for some reason, I thought that economics would be more anthropological than it was. I thought it would be, like you're saying, a kind of interesting way to look at society. And and maths really wasn't my thing at all. So it was quite a shock. Still managed to get the grades, which I was delighted with, but was also very happy to leave it behind. You didn't quite leave it behind very quickly, though, because you went to work in the city after graduating from LSE.
I did. And again, there was no very good reason for doing that. I keep saying there was no internet in my defence for making stupid decisions. But there was no internet, so I had no clue what the city really involved. It wasn't a particularly prized destination at the time. Most of my peers were not going to work for merchant banks, as they were called in those days. They were the precursors to the investment banks of today. And I just read a sort of a cycler-style sheet in the careers office, a scrap of paper, and thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'll apply to those. And I ended up being offered a few jobs. And it was just luck, pure luck. And it's only when I got through the doors of J. Henry Schroeder Wagon Company Limited that I realised what it actually involved.
And what was the environment like there in the, this would be the early to mid 80s, because the images that come to my mind are the kind of Wolf of Wall Street, kind of fat cats in nice suits, lots of men being very loud and angry. Was that the case? Or am I just generalising there massively?
Well, some might have been like that, but this was pre-Big Bang. Big Bang, remember, was the deregulation of the financial sector in Britain, which happened in October 1986. And I joined the city in September, October 1982. So this was pre-Big Bang. It was very gentlemanly, actually, I would say. It was very courteous. I enjoyed it, to tell you the truth. My peers were really nice people. In fact, one of the reasons I think I got the job was because of a key EHS girl. But she was a big shot in the research department of Schroeder's. And she saw KHS on my application. And I think that's why probably my application was fished out of the huge big pile of them. And I got an interview. So a bit of luck there too. But it was actually a very pleasant place to work.
So, Nisha, how do you go from working for a merchant bank to being a BBC news anchor? Like, what were the first kind of steps that you took? When did you realise that actually you were in the wrong career and that you wanted to make a change?
I probably realised within the first month that I'd made a mistake. But then there's no way I could tell my parents I've made a mistake, because they told me all along you shouldn't be doing this. So I could not admit to them. So instead, I kind of bided my time, hoping it would get better and trying to figure out then what should I do. And I applied to all sorts of different things, including to the Investors Chronicle, which was and still is a finance, economics and investment magazine. It's part of the Financial Times group. And I thought, well, I know the economics. I know a bit about markets and investment, and they can teach me the journalism. And indeed, on that basis, I got a job as a financial reporter on the Investors Chronicle. And the first thing I asked for was, please send me on a touch typing course, because in those days we used manual typewriters, would you believe, Ben? So I went every morning to Tottenham Court Road on my way into work for an hour or so, I think, before my work started, and learned how to touch type.
And obviously you ended up in front of the camera. So when did your relationship with the BBC start?
So a couple of years later, I was able to move from the IC, the Investors Chronicle, to the Money Programme at the BBC. I joined as a researcher, so that's the lowliest of the lowliest, and sort of worked my way up. Within a couple of years, I was on screen, became a financial reporter, economics, markets, finance. It was quite wide-ranging, and learnt how to communicate on screen.
And so started with the Money Programme, and then investigative journalism for Panorama as well. Can we talk about investigative journalism as a discipline? I'd love to know. You see, you know, journalists breaking these big stories that become the story that everybody's talking about. How does something like that start? Is that a kind of personal interest that the journalist has? Is it a kind of piece of paper that's dished out in a meeting? You look into this one, Nisha, you look into this one. How does it work to be an investigative journalist? I mean, for example, one of your big stories was Robert Maxwell, is that right?
That's right. Mark Killick, my producer, and I worked together on a big investigation of Maxwell, which went out about 3 weeks, maybe, before he died. A copy of the VHS was on the Lady Guilaine yacht, his yacht, allegedly, apparently. But to answer your question, how does it start? It starts before that, you know, several steps before you get that idea. To have really top quality investigative journalism, the organization has to make it a priority. They need to invest in it. It takes a lot of money to have successful investigations. To run successful investigations, it takes time to make sure you've got the facts right and you've checked and double-checked them. And it takes money, because the subjects that most need investigating are most likely to need legal backup. So Maxwell was very, very litigious. Just to use one example, I did a number of investigations. But Maxwell was very, very litigious. A number of journalists were sniffing around him. But why did we get the story out? Because the BBC in those days was prepared to run very expensive investigations. So we worked very closely with lawyers, in-house lawyers, also with counsel, with Queen's counsel. We really understood the law of libel, of course, I'm talking about. And so as a result of which, the BBC could be as confident as they could be that when we put something out, it would stand up in a court of law. Every sentence, every phrase had to be able to stand up in a court of law. So before you can do those kind of serious investigations, it's not just about having an idea, because there are lots of ideas floating around. You know, journalists talk to each other. We know what's going on. The issue is, will there be an organization with a strong enough stomach and deep enough pockets to fund you to run this investigation?
Would you mind telling us the story of Maxwell for some of our younger listeners? Because we've got obviously old Eds from the Boys and Girls School across the world listening to this podcast, which is fabulous, but also lots of current students who are thinking about their next steps after they leave school. Could you tell us the Maxwell story?
Gosh, I have to put myself back into 1991, 92. It's a long way back, even for me, Ben. So Maxwell was a larger-than-life character, very charismatic. He was a refugee from what's now the Czech Republic, I think. In those days, it was just part of the, I think, Sudeten Czech lands. And he arrived as a penniless refugee in Britain and by sheer force of character turned himself into this larger-than-life, I think he had a really cut crystal English accent. He made himself into this media magnate. He first made his money out of Pergamon Press, which was a publisher of scientific journals. And he made a huge amount of money out of that because nobody was interested in this area of scientific research papers. And you can charge a lot of money for them. There was no internet, remember. Sorry, this is about the 10th time I've said that. And so the actual magazine or the actual publication was essential. You couldn't read the research paper if you didn't subscribe to that particular publication. So he made a lot of money, Pergamon Press. Along the way, he then became a media magnate in the wider sense, and he ended up owning the Daily Mirror. The newspaper, the Daily Mirror, amongst other titles. And he, a lot of people get into newspaper publishing for reasons which are partly driven by ego, let's say, to be polite. And he was one of those very egotistical characters. He was a larger than life, allegedly rather bullying type of individual, and had left a trail of broken careers and broken hearts. He was allegedly was something of a philanderer. At the end of the 1980s, early 90s, there was a terrible recession in Britain. And a number of media companies were hanging in the balance, not just Maxwell's empire. Rupert Murdoch almost lost his business. It was very touch and go for a number of large media organizations, and not just in Britain. Maxwell, in order to save his empire, did things that he really shouldn't have done, I suppose one could say. You can see I'm still talking like an investigative journalist, very carefully and cautiously, even though he's long gone. And amongst other things, he raided the pension fund of the Mirror Group, which is something which is breaks all the duties of trust. And the company was basically going bust. When he died, the great controversy was, did he commit suicide? Was he pushed? In other words, was it murder, which some people allege? He was also allegedly a secret agent. So he was really a colourful character. Or did he just have a heart attack, which is, I think, what probably happened. Because he was a very large man under huge stress. I think it was his demise was probably actually none of these colourful things. And when he died, the whole empire came crashing down about him. And the extent to which he went became evident. The court cases that followed, his two sons were dragged through the courts. It was quite a saga.
And what was your investigation focused on then? What was your story?
A number of different aspects on the way in which he'd run the company, including they ran various competitions, which were not necessarily as clean as they should have been within the newspapers. The newspaper industry was very different, remember, at the time. It was basically highlighting the fact that the company was not in good health, something that he was at great pains not to reveal to the world. We figured out some things about the ownership structure of the company and where it was effectively being held, tax payments. It was a financial investigation, yeah. And, needless to say, he really didn't want to have it out there because it was drawing attention to the world that the company was one step away from bankruptcy.
And what drives you as the journalist here? I mean, I'm sure the answer is probably a number of things, but is it the desire for the truth to be known? Is there a kind of an emotional, you feel as if, you know, raiding the pension fund was morally wrong and that needs to be exposed? Is it just the job? Is that what you have to do? How emotionally connected are you to the stories that you're investigating and then reporting on?
So to be fair, in the Maxwell story, we didn't identify that the pension fund had been raided. Nobody knew that until after he died. What we identified was that the company was on its knees and was doing a range of things that were highly dubious. But what drives any journalist, let alone an investigative journalist? Yeah, to some extent, it's a quest for the truth. Some people just have that, you know, slightly obsessive tendency. I'm probably one of those. You know, you get the bit between the teeth and you just keep going. It's partly about just wanting to understand the world. You know, I went to LSE and the motto of LSE is something like, to understand the causes of things. Yeah, that's it. To understand the causes of things. And I think that's actually a great motto for any journalist.
Absolutely.
Hi, I'm Zana.
And I'm Bedu, and we've been fundraising in support of the Assisted Places Scheme across each school. What's that, you ask?
The Assisted Places Scheme aims to provide access to excellence for all. So if you want to make a change,
start small and support the campaign. Thank you.
It's a thoroughly interesting conversation, and thank you for going back into the memory there and talking about that. I'd love to talk about the role of the news anchor as well. And something that you said, you were on air during the 9/11 attacks, and I saw you speaking in an interview. You said, simultaneously, I had to process my reaction as a human being, but at the same time, I was a BBC news anchor who had to stay calm and composed. Can you tell me your memories of that day? From you're not just, as you say, a human being processing this, but you're somebody who's having to try and process this and tell the world about it as part of BBC World News.
Yeah, sure. So 9/11 2001, which is the 11th of September 2001, was probably the worst day of my working life. And I say that because it was so traumatic for me personally, because, as you say, I was simultaneously working and being the calm and collected face of the BBC, but at the same time, a human being trying to make sense of what on earth was happening. And I didn't know what was happening. And why was that? Because it was the first 2 hours that I covered. So we tended to work in the first half of the hour for a show and then be down for half an hour and then go back and do the next hour. And this was quarter to the hour. So it was during my break. I was in the middle of eating a sandwich and someone came up to me and said, Niche, just get on to set. One of the Twin Towers is on fire. So quarter to two in the afternoon, which is probably about quarter to eight maybe in New York, or quarter to nine in the morning. And I had no clue. Nobody knew what it was. We just thought one of the Twin Towers was on fire. We went on air just to say one of the Twin Towers is on fire, and you just have to keep talking, say something. And then it became apparent that it wasn't just a fire, a plane had gone into the building. I thought, okay, that must be some kind of freak accident. She's talking about it. A plane has gone in, free. And then the pictures start coming in of a second plane going into the second tower, at which point a little voice is saying, this is no accident. But what do you say it is in that situation? You can't say, holy moly, this is no accident. This is something we've never seen before. Remember, nobody had thought about planes being used as weapons before 2001. You just have to stay super calm and just say what you see and try and take all the emotion out of the voice and be the proverbial swan while the mind is ferociously dashing about trying to process it. It was extremely difficult. It was truly horrendous.
And how much is on you in that position? Because you always kind of think of the news presenter as the face of the news. There's a producer in their ear. But as, you know, obviously your background is journalism. And how much of that was on your shoulders? How much support, production support, did you have when, you know, one of the biggest moments of all history, all time, is unfolding in front of your eyes? How much support did you have around you?
In some ways, very little support, but that's not because, that's not criticism of the people around me. It's just everybody else was running around trying to figure out what was going on too. And they were trying to just get material to me. So there was very little voice in my ear telling me what to do. I just knew I had to keep going. And so I had a screen in front of me with wires. But remember, there was no... it's not that there was no internet. There was internet, and we did have wires coming through from the news agencies, Reuters and PA and so on. But what we didn't have was Twitter, for instance. There was no social media telling you. So you didn't have eyewitness accounts coming in immediately. That would have been very different now. But when was Twitter formed? 2007, 2008? And 9/11 took place in 2001. So you were really in a news vacuum. And I felt like, as anyone would have done under those circumstances, very alone. Actually, I don't think I had time to feel, to tell you the truth, Ben. I really don't think that's what it was about. You just had to keep going. It's only later that you can reflect, my word, I was so alone. At the time, I think you just have to keep going. And a lot happened in those 2 hours, you know. So the two first planes went, the first plane went in, the second plane went in, then the third plane went into the Pentagon, if you remember, in Washington, D.C. And the fourth plane was hijacked and it ended up crashing into a field in Pennsylvania, if you recall. And then the first Twin Tower collapsed into the dust of Manhattan. And then the second Twin Tower collapsed down to its foundations. And only then were those first 2 hours up and I walked off set. So all the main elements of the story took place in the first 2 hours. There wasn't enough time to think.
As an anchor, I mean, this in particular, that was something, as you say, you know, planes had never been thought that planes could be used as a weapon. And it's, you know, as we've said, a moment in history that will always be remembered. As a news anchor, do you ever get desensitized to the stories that you're reporting on? I mean, you know, especially at the moment, for example, there seems to be very little good news happening in the world. Do you get desensitized? Do you just learn to deliver these stories and, you know, you leave work at work? Or what kind of emotional toll does that have on a news anchor who is constantly surrounded by and constantly delivering bad news?
It's a good question, Ben. I think it depends on the individual. I found that 9/11 followed me for months after that. And I had very young children and I just didn't want them to know about it. We used to travel to India every year to see my parents. So we had to get on a plane. And I never wanted them to know that a plane could be used as a weapon. So I never discussed it with my husband when we were at home. It took a long time to process what had happened. And I think that's probably the case for most of my colleagues. You know, if you've worked in a theatre of war, for instance, I don't think you ever really leave it. Or it ever leaves you, I should say.
So, Nisha, you spent 20 years working as a journalist, but you've changed your career again. You're now a conference host, a motivational speaker, and a coach. What prompted you to leave the BBC and start this new chapter?
So I've been talking to you about 9/11, which was living really at my wit's end. But most news anchoring isn't like that. It's quite formulaic. And you're not really being stretched to the utmost. And after a while, it became a bit formulaic almost, Ben. And I just thought I needed to do something which was deeper. Remember, I used to be an investigative journalist. And I wanted to work in areas where I could get under the skin of the subject more. And I've done some wonderful jobs, really difficult jobs, where I'm working live. Remember, I also said that the theatre is the thing I loved when I was a kid. So when you're running a show on stage, you're moderating a conference or a big meeting, there's a bit of a theatre impresario in you, and it's live, and you're working with an audience, and you have several days to really prepare a difficult subject. They're usually quite pointy-headed. For instance, I did a show for CERN, the Particle Physics Laboratory, on particle physics and astrophysics. It was the most wonderful show, probably the most difficult thing I've done in ages. But I was truly alive working with physicists because it's so hard. And so, yeah, it's considerably more satisfying in some ways than being a news anchor.
And you, before we started recording, you said that you're essentially moderating meetings. You're bringing these experts together, and you're helping to lead and guide the discussion. You mentioned earlier on you were an aware child. You're obviously well educated, opinionated. It must have been difficult to stay impartial sometimes working as a journalist and as a news anchor. Is that something that you can do now? Is it nice to have almost the shackles off, that you're allowed to have an opinion on what's happening in the world around us rather than just delivering the facts?
Actually, I'm very proud of the impartiality tradition of the BBC. I remember once meeting somebody who was embedded with the US Army during the Iraq War, and he said that such and such general was very fond of you, Nisha. And I thought, oh my God, no, I don't like the sound of that. And he said, I liked her because you never knew where she was coming from. She always kept her opinions to herself. And then I thought, oh, okay, I'll take that praise then. So I think it's actually a great thing to be impartial and to be able to be sufficiently detached from a story, to be able to see both sides of it. And look at the world we live in right now. We have to be able to see both sides. So I live on the Isle of Wight, which is quite a Brexity sort of place. It voted by a large margin for Brexit. I know a lot of friends who voted for Brexit. I didn't. And I still believe, on economic grounds, it was the wrong thing for the country to do. But I can have really interesting, calm discussions with people who have the opposite view. And I really understand where they're coming from. And I think that if I hadn't been a journalist and hadn't worked for the BBC, I wouldn't be able to do that. So I think that's something very precious, that tradition of impartiality.
It's something that's being called into question at the moment, Nisha. I've never worked for the BBC. I've worked in the commercial radio in the UK for a decade. Always respected the BBC. And still, my personal opinion is that it's a wonderful institution that we should do everything that we possibly can to protect. As someone who was within the BBC, knows how it works, is now out of it, from an objective point of view, does it anger you when you see that the BBC is being attacked from what seems like all sides at the moment?
Yeah, 'twas ever thus. And that's exactly it. You put it, it's attacked from all sides. And that's where the BBC should be, right? You don't want to please anyone particularly.
Well, quite. Is the BBC, is it an institution that's going to be with us for a long time? Is it something that, I don't know, death by a thousand cuts sometimes springs to mind when you think about the BBC and the pressure it's under? Is it here to stay?
Who knows, Ben? I mean, do you know whether our great leader is here to stay? I mean, who knows? One thing you learn as an economist is you don't try and predict the future.
And I think that's very sensible. Nisha, there's one question that I ask everybody who comes on this podcast, and it's what characteristic would you say has served you best throughout your career? As you know, we've got old Eds from Boys and Girls School listening, but also current students who are thinking about their next steps in life after they cross Edgbaston Park Road for the very last time. What characteristic would you say has served you best since leaving school?
That's a really good question, Ben, and may I say you're a very good interviewer.
High praise indeed.
I think the characteristic that served me best is something I actually learnt at KEHS, funnily enough, and that is to own my voice. Remember I said I went from a co-ed school in India to this girls' school, which I thought was rather odd to begin with. But the great thing about a girls' school is that it enables you to express yourself. And that doesn't really happen with girls in co-ed schools. And having your own voice, knowing your position, being able to express your opinion courageously is extremely important. And I hope that KHS still continues that tradition as it did when I was there. And I think that has really stood me in good stead in so many different roles over the last 40 years since I left school.
Nisha Pillay, host, motivational speaker, coach, and of course, former BBC News presenter. It's been fascinating to speak to you today. And thank you ever so much for joining me on Ed Talks.
Likewise, Ben, and I've learned a few interviewing tips from you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Ed Talks. I hope that you've enjoyed today's conversation. If you have, it would be great if you could subscribe to this podcast on whatever app you're listening on, so you can keep up to date with future episodes. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave your feedback in the review section. If you're listening on a platform where you can't leave your comments, then please do email me with your feedback. My email address is ben@soundrebel.co.uk. If you would like to feature on this podcast as a guest, then please email Adelaide Bailey at the Development Office. Her email address is aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. That's aab@kes.beeham.sch.uk. She's also the person to email with any news that you think should be featuring in Old Ed's publications, either in print or online. Finally, if you think a podcast would enhance the communications of your business, organisation or charity, then I'd love to talk to you about producing it. My email address again is ben@soundrebel.co.uk.